I'm going to start by saying I'm Jim Mackin, and I'm here to interview Don McCarthy, and we're in Ramsey, Montana. So let's go ahead and get started. First, just some biographical questions. What is your full name?
Donald Edward McCarthy.
Donald Edward McCarthy. And where and when were you born?
I was born in Butte, Montana, 1951.
Okay, the beginning of the 50s then. Huh? And did you grow up in Butte?
I grew up in Butte.
And where have you lived?
Since?
Mm-hmm.
I lived, I went and did my undergraduate work in the late 60s and early 70s at Montana Tech as an engineer, and spent my early part of, a very short period of time in the mining industry in Arizona, just outside of Tucson, then moved from there to Oakland, California to work for Kaiser Steel Corporation as a young engineer still. Spent about 2.5 years there. Moved into student housing at Berkeley, went to graduate school at Berkeley for another 2.5 years. Finished that degree in 1979 and moved to Denver, Colorado. Raised a family in Denver for the succeeding 20 years, but did projects around the country through that 20-year period of time. So I lived in New York City for a period, Houston, Texas for a period, Lake Charles, Louisiana for a period, Baton Rouge, Louisiana for a period, Los Angeles for a period, but always, you know, had my bases Denver, and my family went to grade school, high school, and, you know, essentially grew up in Colorado.
Okay. The what kind of jobs were these? You started in mining.
They were, you know, they were always technology companies connected to the mining industry. And I had various positions from young engineer to begin with all the way up to company president level positions. And all of them in between.
And what's your profession right now?
I'm semi-retired, but I manufacture a product that I developed that's used in the mining and civil construction industry. We manufacture it. We have a patent on it, and we manufacture it to service that industry. It's a tool used essentially to break rock as an alternative to high explosives.
Okay. And are you? Do you still work out of Denver in managing that company?
No, we actually manufacture it in Malta, Montana. I don't have any day-to-day responsibility anymore. I handle the, you know, just sort of the intellectual property side of it primarily, while others do the, you know, the basic day-to-day heavy lifting.
So you're not that active in McCarthy Industries anymore, or is that...
Yeah, no, I'm not active day to day.
And but that's still based in Denver, isn't it?
Well, I consider it really based in Malta, Montana, but I can't keep that address just because it's been around for a long time.
The Denver.
Yeah.
Okay.
We have a condo down there that somebody lives in and takes care of and kind of handles that mailing stuff.
And well, you said you raised a family. I assume you were married.
Yes.
Are you still married?
I'm not.
Okay. Divorced, widowed?
Divorced.
Okay. At what age did you marry?
I was 22 years old.
22. So you married before you went to Oakland and Berkeley?
Correct.
And things
just... very, you know, I mean, essentially, well, we were married in living, I was finishing up school for about the last 6 months in 1974, and then left, you know, that that summer of graduation for my first position in the mining industry in the Tucson area. It was just outside of Tucson, slightly north, slightly east at a mining property called Silver Bell, which at the time was owned by a company called Asarco, which since numerous divestitures and acquisitions is now, the properties at least, are owned by the big Mexican mining conglomerate.
Oh, is that right? Mm-hmm. All those mines are in Tucson?
Not all of them, but the ones that Asarco actually owned.
Was your spouse of Irish ancestry?
She was not. She grew up in Butte, but she was from the Eastern European group. We had a special name for them. We call them the Bohunks.
Right.
In fact, it's not really a slang term anymore. We sort of use that as a kind of a badge of honor, a bit like the Cajuns do with Kunas.
Right.
But I'm half, actually. I'm half Irish and half Bohunk.
Mm-hmm.
Which, in fact, if you go into my generation, and certainly afterwards, you'll find a surprisingly percentage of people that grew up in Butte are of that half and half ancestry.
Yes, I've met quite a few mm-hmm. people like that.
It's surprising, and some will have the Bohunk name. And I'll use the term as opposed to Croatian, Slovenian, mm-hmm. Czechoslovakian, German, you know, right. It sort of lumps everybody in. But you'll find that they'll have that European or Eastern European name, but they'll be half Irish. In fact, mm-hmm. my cousin is a fairly well-known guy in the sports field. His name is Sonny Lubick. He was the head coach at Colorado State for many years.
Sure, I remember.
And of course, he carries the name Lubick, which was my mother's family name, but his mother was Irish. So he as well mm-hmm. is half and half, but, you know, in the mirror image of the ancestral pool.
Yeah, it seems very common.
It's unique to the immigration pattern, really. If you research or study that, you'll find that back in that era, which was around the turn of the 1900s, that people emigrated. They might have passed through more typically Boston and or New York, but they found their way somewhere where there was work activity relative to the experience of the region they came from. So you will find interesting pockets of people that will, in say mining communities around the West as an example, you'll find that in Butte is a great example. The Irish of Butte are not just, you know, a mix of Irishmen from Ireland. They all come from one little area called the Bearhaven Peninsula. And the reason they come from the Bearhaven Peninsula is because there was mining activity back there at that time. And when they emigrated here, they found their way to mining areas where they could apply their experience. And so the first guys that came developed their, jobs and families, and then they would bring relatives and friends and so forth. And so it kind of grew up as a very tight-knit group of Irishmen from the same area, mm-hmm. this very small area of Ireland. And you find actually the Eastern European group as well. You'll find some Germans, a lot of Slovenian, Croatian. There was mining there. So as a result of that, they found their way to mining centers. So you had I'd say back in those days, there was probably 50% of more of the population of Butte were the Irish. They were the real heart of the emigration early on, and then all the rest of the groups. You had some of the Italian, you had some Scandinavians. They were, you know, there's a lot of hard rock mining back in Scandinavia in those days, so you'll get a few of the a population of Scandinavian from those days here. So the Irish would have been 50% or more, and all the rest of the groups would have been, their other 50% or less.
But most of them came from mining areas themselves.
They came from mining areas. And then you find them, if you go back and research emigration patterns, you'll find that the Germans of the coal mining regions came from the Ruhr Valley.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the steel-making guys from the Midwest around the Great Lakes came from a lot, both from Germany, but a lot from those Polish steelmaking regions. So there was it was relative to their work experience. That was what they had to sell back then.
So most of the folks that came here didn't come here to learn a new job. that came with some skills.
Well, they didn't really have a choice. I mean, that was mm-hmm. their stock and trade at the time. Mm-hmm. You know, it wasn't. Those were the days of industrialization, and the intellectual property part of the game didn't come till much later. The capital was big. Capital was what it took, and they needed experienced people, and that was their stock and trade. That's what they had to sell.
When did your own Irish ancestors come?
My grandfather came right around the turn of the last century. I don't really recall exactly the date, but he had kind of an interesting history. He actually was kind of an adventurer as a young man, but he was fairly unique in that he was a graduate of Trinity College because his family were fairly high up the social stratum in Ireland. His father was the superintendent of his father, which would have been my great grandfather, was the superintendent of schools of one region.
Was it in the county?
So that was a fairly yes. So that was a fairly significant, government post of its day. Mm-hmm. So he could have certainly, and he, of course, the privilege of going and getting a college education, you know, sometime in the late 1800s, you can imagine that there's very few gifted that opportunity. Mm-hmm. But the adventure of it was too great of a tractor beam pull. And so he came to the U.S. And as I understood it from my father, he, because by virtue of that education, he landed his first job relatively soon after he got off the boat in Boston at one of the colleges. I think it was either Boston College or MIT or one of them there. I don't really recall exactly, as a teaching post.
Mm-hmm.
His forte was, I think, the English language. So he taught, classical English. And I guess, as I understand it from my father, he was quite a brilliant guy. They relied on him in Butte to keep the books and sort of do a lot of the administrative stuff back in those really early days. In the early, 1900s, like before 1910 even. He was kind of unique in that regard. They called him, his nickname was Smart Jack.
Oh, Smart Jack, that's interesting because of the nickname of the cousin Jacks here.
Right, yeah. Well, because his first name was Jack in that case. So, but he was just sort of seen as the intellectual of Butte at the in that day.
And did you know anything about what the sister, when he arrived, what the schools were like in Butte?
That I don't. There wasn't that much discussion about that for some reason. In my family, just wasn't a subject that ever had any interest.
Well, you said your mixed ancestry, but what does your Irish ancestry mean to you?
I'm very proud of it. And probably because in Butte, even particularly through my generation when I grew up, there was still it was predominantly an Irish culture. It didn't matter what gene pool you came from. I mean, St. Patrick's Day celebrations were huge. Everybody engaged in them. Everybody kind of saw themselves as part of that cultural, attitude. And I never thought a lot about it, but when I was early in my career as a young engineer, I traveled quite a bit to Europe.
Mm-hmm.
And I mostly Central, Northern Europe and to Ireland a couple of times. And I never thought much about the melting pot aspect that we were gifted in Butte until I traveled to these places, and I could see then clear similarities between. I would spend time in Finland as an example, and we had a Finn town here, as you probably know, and it was sort of the mix of all the Scandinavian groups, but I think predominantly Finland. And I could see the names, I could see the look of the mm-hmm. friends I went to high school with, the attitude that they had. And it was very surprising to me. I mean, it was interesting, fascinating. It was a real learning experience, really opened my eyes to that kind of thing, you know, how the genetic thread of people really carry forward for many, many generations. Here it was just, you know, you're just a kid in a little mining town. You never thought, you know, of anything about a name and associate with somebody that really came from another land, and that they would still be somewhat similar to those people in a lot of personal characteristics. And the one thing I remember thinking when I was, you know, traveled to Ireland during that period, and at that time I was still only 28, 29 years old, so I was still a fairly young guy as well. I'm 59 today. I thought to myself as I was rambling around Ireland that the entire country would come out at 8 in the evening to the pubs, and that was the social, you know, engagement. They didn't have house parties, you know, they didn't have block parties, they didn't have little cliques of people that got together in this little club or that little club. The whole country came out and enjoyed the whole society out in the pubs. Every night. And when I look back on that, even from that experience, that was what it was like in Butte. We weren't house party people. You know, if we wanted a social activity, we all went out to the pubs and engaged with the whole community. And that's very Irish. You know, that's an engaging kind of behavior. And so I saw a lot of similarities, you know, to the Irish of Butte. And, you know, to old Ireland. And in fact, it brought all the other cultures into that same behavior. So sure. The Irish tenor of culture really was a strong force in this little town.
I want to go back a little bit. Your, was it your grandfather was teaching in Boston?
Yes, well, as soon as he got off the boat, because of his education at Trinity College in Ireland, his first job he found, I guess, very quickly, according to my father, very quickly as a teaching post in one of the universities there. And I, you know, I'm just not 100% sure, you know, Boston College. It was one of the early, you know, I don't know if it was MIT or something that MIT grew into, but it was one of the early colleges that was in Boston, and it was an English teaching post.
Now, what then led him out to Montana?
He just he wanted the adventure. That was the whole thing for coming to the U.S. He just, you know, that wasn't enough. He wanted to get out to where the, you know, they were, you know, campaigning the New World. And he found Butte because of so many of the people from that part of Ireland were here. So he came essentially to his people as well. As a young man.
And so
it was all about, as far, according to my father, it was just all about the adventure. He just sought the adventure of doing that.
And Butte America, then, I guess.
Yeah.
Was a place he could identify
yeah,
with.
Yeah, you know, he could identify with his people. I mean, he wasn't a mining guy. You know, he had a different background, but that was what it was all about.
The name McCarthy is a fairly common name in Cork. Was there ever any discussion in your family about the origins of the name or what it meant?
Well, my cousin Larry McCarthy, he got very interested in the genealogy of the family, and he actually went back to Ireland a number of times throughout his life doing that research and put a fairly extensive family tree together.
Is it something you discuss in the family?
Not really. It was interesting. No one really got into that fact until much, much later in their lives. Larry died a couple of years ago at about 75 years old. He didn't probably start that process till he was in his 50s.
Oh.
You know, when I look back and I sort of evaluate that's actually a pretty good question, but when I look back and evaluate that question, What I realize is that at that time in particular, we were really Americans. We weren't, you know, this kind of American or that kind of American. That sort of sense came much later. As people, as some groups started to try to identify themselves, you know, as some kind of American, then it sort of, you know, flowed through the population in a way where then everybody decided that they were some kind of an American. And if you were some kind of an American, then the next step would be, well, you know, how does all that work? You know, what kind of American mm-hmm. are we? But if you go back to that generation, they never talked about that. They were Americans. They just kind of knew where their people generally came from. They could tell you a little bit of a story, but they weren't passionate about it, like the younger generation who had none or very little connectivity. That's became kind of a fad much later in the...
Mm. Were there any traditional first names, say, or nicknames that were used in your family?
You know, my family was not big on nicknames for some odd reason, and you kind of... that happens real young in life. You get sort of called something and it sticks. And I'm not sure why in our family that we just never ended up with a nickname. I'm happy to say that that wasn't the case, because some of them were pretty rugged. But back in that era, probably a majority of kids did, you know, get labeled a nickname.
Well, let's talk about your childhood growing up in Duke then. What neighborhood were you in?
I grew up in what would probably be more in the center of town. The area was South Colorado Street, and its lateral border was Second. So Second and Colorado, essentially. That was only probably 6 or 8 city blocks south of the uptown area of the day. So we were pretty close to that part. It didn't really have a district name to it, but it would, you know, geographically it was pretty close to like the center of the metro area.
Did you identify yourselves as a neighborhood? Say as the kids, did you group?
Well, back then actually, you didn't really identify yourself as a neighborhood specifically. You identified yourself as the neighborhood school you went to, predominantly. Mm-hmm. I mean, back in my time, there were, you know, more or as many Catholic schools, grade schools, as there were public grade schools. So you kind of associated one another with where you went to grade school at that age, you know, mm-hmm. at grade school age. I went to St. Joseph's, so I was, you know, from the St. Joseph's area, and then other guys would be, you know, St. Lawrence and, you know, St. Pat's, and you kind of knew where those areas were.
Sure.
And that's how you identified yourself. Now, there were a couple of areas where it was also identified as a district. You've probably heard these names, but one would have been Centerville.
Sure.
Another, Walkerville. McQueen Addition and Meterville. Those were 4 other areas where people kind of identified themselves on top of the school they might have gone to, or in addition to the school they might have gone to. But everywhere else, it was just primarily, you know, it wasn't so much the school, it was the parish, you know, St. Joe's Parish, you know, such and such. That was your parish, that was, and everybody had a general idea, you know, where those boundary limits were.
Sure, and the parishes all had regional boundaries.
Yes.
And you went to school.
And they had a school there. Every parish had a school there.
Do you recall any games that you played as a child? Were they, I guess the question would be, were these regular American games? Was there any Irish influence, do you think, in the games that you were playing?
No. Like I say, that generation, there was a reason for it. That generation was, hang on a second. That generation that we were fathered by were all American, and so they never really tried to bring any classical old country stuff to their kids. I mean, you know, right down. I mean, that's one of the big debates today about regarding language as one example. That you know, now a lot of groups want to have their language as part of the fabric of America. Mm-hmm. Back then, that generation wanted nothing to do with that part of the old country. They were all American, and everything was American. So it was all basketball, football, baseball, period.
All the basic sports that were here then.
We never even thought about this kind of thing until much, much later. And I don't think, I would imagine that a lot of people that never left the area, even in my generation and certainly, you know, forward from me, probably think about it today. Mm-hmm. It just wasn't part of the fabric of the culture. I mean, people were all American here. They weren't, you know, something American, this American or that American. That came much, much later.
And so you didn't recognize some things that may have been Irish connections until you actually went to Ireland and could see that.
No connections whatsoever. No connections. We had a St. Patrick's Day celebration, and it was just the St. Patrick. I mean, we kind of had an idea that there was some Irish, you know, history to that, but not to the degree you would think today. I mean, because everybody was out enjoying the St. Patrick's Day celebration. It wasn't just the Irish.
Hmm. What size household did you have?
There were two of us, is all. My mother, father, myself, and my brother. But he's much older. He's 13 years older than I. So we had quite a gap in our you know, family. But there was only two of us. And of course, as you know, a lot of the families, the Irish families in Butte, would have, you know, 5, 6, 8, you know.
There are however many that could.
Right, yeah.
And so the neighborhood you grew up in was then, I would take it, a middle-class neighborhood.
Yeah, you know, middle-class for the time. I mean, you look now back, and I mean, it was, nobody really had anything back then. Like now, I mean, you can see, now you can go to just any city in America, and you see clear differences between social status of this mm-hmm. neighborhood or that neighborhood. But back then, everybody was pretty much in the same boat. I mean, even the top people, which essentially were the management of the Anaconda Company that existed at that time, or its subsidiary companies like the Montana Power, you know, they had a, you know, maybe a little nicer house, but I mean, not like today. Mm. I mean, today, these guys, some of these guys in that are executives of these corporations will have 20,000 square foot mansions somewhere, you know. Mm. Not these guys at the time. So you never really realized that you were, there was this real economic stratification. You just never really recognized it. It just wasn't in your face. It really didn't, in fact, exist at the time. That also came much later.
So would you be, say, within the parish, would you be playing with children of management or higher-ups and things like that? Were they part of the normal
yes.
parish?
They were part of the normal, even through high school. In fact, I would say still that the people that are still connected with this town, whether they've stayed here their entire lives or whether they've come back like I have, pretty much operate that way. I don't notice any of that that social stratification or caste system existing here even to this day.
And did you play sports yourself?
I didn't play the football, baseball, basketball. I was more golf, skiing type activities. What I enjoyed.
Any team sports? And
no team sports. I guess probably it's my personality. I'm kind of you know, like to do things on my own. As you evidence from the place I live at here, it's, you know, mm-hmm. I don't have any neighbors even. Not that I'm not, you know, not that I don't have a decent personality and don't like people, but I just like my privacy and I don't care to have anybody dictate my, you know, mm-hmm. my life. I am very comfortable running my own show.
And do you stay in touch with your friends?
Oh, yeah.
Childhood?
Oh, yeah, sure. Not, I mean, you know, I don't think anybody can claim they have, you know, dozens of real friends. But the guys that I really enjoyed and I considered good friends back in the day are still my friends today, and we still get together and stay in touch.
You didn't mention any military experience.
I was not in the military. I was actually at Montana Tech at that time. And I back then, I don't, most people probably don't recall, but they had a lottery system. And I was just one of those, I guess would be considered the luck of the Irish. I got a very, very high lottery number, so it never got to me.
So you didn't have to worry about the draft, and you were able to then continue your career.
Yes.
And your education.
Right, yeah. I mean, some of my friends, we were balling school together, and some guys got like number three, number two, and mine was number 293. I mean, this is almost 40 years ago, and I still remember that number. 293.
That you mentioned the parish being kind of the identifying area there. Was the parish in any way identifiably Irish? Or, I mean, did you have Irish priests? Did you have, or was it...
Yes, back then I would say the predominant religious class, at the priesthood level, were Irish. I'm looking back now, and of course I'm going back to grade school, which is 45 years, 50, almost 50 years ago, and that, you know, as I recall, they were Irish names, and I as I recall, they spoke with a very literal Irish brogue at the time. So they actually came from Ireland even during that period, that later period, just to become priests in the area.
You'd be talking about the early 60s or something?
Right, 50s.
Late 50s, early
yeah.
60s. Yeah. That as a member of the parish, do you recall at the importance of the various festivals and church festivals and things like that?
You know, I don't really recall that. I don't really ever recall an organized church festival activity. It was primarily just, you know, they had days of church and various kinds of formalized mass type celebrations, and you just went to them on some schedule. I mean, all of us kids in grade school at the time were, you put your duty in as altar boys.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that was one of the mandatory things when you went to a Catholic grade school.
And it was Latin.
It was Latin. And I was miserable. In fact, I'm not sure why they didn't throw me right off the deal, but somehow I survived.
So you and most of the boys that you grew up with,
right,
served as altar boys.
Yes,
and,
right.
I
kind of recall it was more you were conscripted into it. You know, it wasn't necessarily. I suppose there were a few guys that, you know, were volunteers, but as I recall, it was a mandatory service.
Was there any discrimination on who had to take the early masses versus?
No.
Did you have any family traditions, say like going to midnight mass or something like that on Christmas?
Not really, not that I recall. My family was really, I would say, laissez-faire about that kind of thing. You know, my mother was, like I said, she was on the. She was Croatian, and she was on the Bohunk side of the group, and she was extremely religious. I mean, my father wasn't really that religious. His father died. My grandfather I was describing earlier. At a fairly young age, when those siblings were preteen,
mm-hmm.
and they went to live in the Catholic orphanage in Helena, and that was a brutal existence back then. The nuns there apparently were tyrannical, And I mean, it was common to, you know, suffer a lot of abuse and beatings and so forth. And so with that experience, as you can imagine, he just wasn't that keen on religion after he suffered, you know, that kind of torment. Mm-hmm. And when he was a young guy, just younger, like around, say, 15, 16 years old, and his brother would have been, you know, say, for around 17 or so, they were taken out of that orphanage by a fellow by the name of Ed Leahy. And Ed was a real, kind of a real flamboyant Irishman of his day. Has mining interests around, and he had the biggest bootlegging operation in the, you know, this part of the United States. And he brought these kids. He knew my grandfather, and so he got them out of the orphanage and looked after them. But of course, then they're part of the family that's running the biggest bootlegging operation in this part of the Northwest.
That was again, was that the Prohibition period?
That was during the Prohibition period. Yeah.
And. So,
but my mother, she, you know, back to the religious side, she was the one that was very religious. I mean, the Eastern European group were highly religious. In fact, I'd say if you're going to grade religious fervor, mm-hmm. the Bohunks were way more religious than the Irish. Mm-hmm. I mean, the Irish may have talked the talk, but I'm telling you, the Bohunks walked the walk. And my mother walked to church every day.
Oh, so she went to
every
daily
day,
mass.
Every mm-hmm. single day.
And whereas your father and most of the Irish that you knew, they celebrated St. Patrick's Day, but it was a festival and it wasn't particularly a holy day.
Oh, not St. Patrick's Day. No, no, that was a classical party. Festival party.
Do you recall, did your father say give up drinking for Lent or anything like that?
Well, my father was never a big drinker for some reason. A lot of the Irish guys that he knew, of course, were certified alcoholics, but he wasn't. For some reason, he was just one of those unique personalities that even though you're around it, and I mean, and actually in their teenage years, they grew up in a bootlegging family. Or they were raised partly in a bootlegging family. He just wasn't a drinker, and his older brother wasn't a drinker. They just weren't big drinkers.
But that didn't make a big thing out of Lent then either.
Well, my father, like I say, he grew up with such a brutal experience with the Catholic orphanage in Helena that he wasn't against it. He didn't, you know, he wasn't one of these guys that, you know, you have a bad experience, now I'm going to bring everybody else in. Not, you know, you were on, you, you know, you live your life, you make your own decisions, you make your own analyses, but where I weigh in is I just don't buy it anymore after that experience as essentially a preteen. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of where he personally weighed in on religion. So we didn't have much of that pressure from him, but on my mother's side, she made up for it.
did she impose rules for Lent and things like that?
Or? You know, not really. And
I mean,
probably,
there were food rules, I think.
Well, you're right. Now that I think back, you'll have to forgive me of my age. My mm-hmm. memory's not perfect, but every Friday we would have fish, mm-hmm. as an example, as I grew up. Yeah, we had those little simple rules, but they weren't. I don't really recall the fasting part, to be honest with you. You know, I mean, I never felt hungry a day in my life. But we did observe that, fish type, you know, non-meat Fridays.
Mm-hmm. So you were raised, if you followed the path of your father, then you didn't take religion to be the center of your life.
No, that's correct. That's correct. And I don't know if it was just the convenience of you know, I was able to be lazy as by virtue of that, or if it was just the way I, decided to take it on board. I mean, I have a spiritual sense about me, but not in an organized religious way.
Mm-hmm. When you grew up in that community, what were most of the people working at?
Most of the people were somehow associated with the mine itself. They were either miners or electricians or mechanics, or worked for the companies that would service the mining industry, you know, the tire guys, you know, the spare parts guys. So pretty much everybody in town was connected to that mining industry. It was everything. I mean, it was a dominant, an incredibly dominant economic force. I mean, it actually spawned off the Montana Power Company. The Montana Power mm-hmm. Company just didn't come out of the ether. The mining industry required massive amounts of power, and they capitalized the power company to deliver that power. And then, of course, over the generation or over the decades, Montana Power became a well-recognized large public utility in its own right. Mm-hmm. But back then, everybody really worked either directly for or on the peripheral of the mining industry. In fact, Montana Tech was underwritten by the Anaconda Company. They needed engineers. They wanted a supply of engineering talent for this heavy industry that existed here. On came Montana Tech, at the time Montana School of Mines. Mm-hmm. It didn't actually get renamed until 1967 or 8. Yeah, it was the School of Mines up until that period of time.
That seemed to happen to a lot of School of Mines around the country, and the same thing happened, I think, in terms of teaching schools.
Right. I think it was probably driven by, the economics of education by the time you got getting close to the 70s, where they just couldn't support an institution like that only on the narrow fields of engineering. They just couldn't get enough student body. So they started opening up additional degree opportunities. And that got to a point where it just started making sense to name it a bit more open-ended, to accommodate the other disciplines. And of course today, even I graduated in 1974, and today they've got probably, I know, in fact, they have many, many more degrees outside of those core four or five engineering degrees than they even had back then.
Sure. How did your father, coming out of the orphanage, find his way into employment?
Well, he was taken out of, him and he and his brother were taken out of the orphanage by a family friend, and they were made part of that family. And they had mining interests in the area, but they were a very large commercial bootlegging operation. My dad said his job early on was to drive the sugar truck. They had to go acquire the sugar at one location, the different commodities, and they'd bring them in large bulk. They had a big operation back in the mountains up by Boulder, Colorado. And so he would drive the sugar one way, and I think he might have even driven the finished product another way. They had distribution locations all over. According to him, they were the largest operation in this region of the country.
So they were making their own whiskey. They weren't just bringing it in from
Canada. They manufactured it, yeah. They were that kind of bootlegger. They manufactured it.
Well, I assume then that he had to move out of that.
Well, that's a fascinating story, actually. What happened when he got to be about 19 years old, of course, back then, everybody knows the story and the history. Nobody really generally bought off on this prohibition, really. I mean, particularly the local authorities, they were kind of subscribing to the federal law, but, they like to go out and have a drink, and, nobody was really into it. But the system was kind of an opportunity for the officialdom, police and others, to have, an extra income from it by sort of letting it go. Even though they were enjoying it themselves, that was a bit of an income for them. That was pretty much, you know, the same all over the country. And so they were paying, you know, the various entities off, and life was going on, and they were in operation. And then towards the end, you know, before it was getting to the end of Prohibition, I think the heat was ramping up, because now you had a battle between the public officials that wanted to maintain their positions of privilege by superimposing Prohibition. And there's always whenever you put a government regulation in play, there's going to be a class of bureaucrat that gets privileged by that. Mm-hmm. And they don't want to lose that privilege. And they could see that change is coming. You know, the society was starting to, you know, realize what a waste of money and time this is becoming. And they were fighting against that, trying to hold it down and keep it down. So they got to a point where they couldn't really, you know, make these payoffs in the sort of the happy laissez-faire period. And they were going to get shut down. They were going to get nabbed. And as my dad was telling me the story, they got a tip. And so they all ran home. They got their stash of funds, and they jumped in their cars, and they headed to California. And he said they rented a real nice, he said, a movie star's house somewhere in Los Angeles, and hid out for a year or year and a half or so, not very long before the law was actually repealed. But he said they really lived quite well as a result during that period of time, you know, where cash was quite, during a deflationary depression, one of the kings happens to be cash. Mm-hmm. So they were able to live quite well down there and weather, you know, the final days of, Prohibition getting, you know, repealed. And then they all came back, and of course they're young guys. They're still, you know, 21, 20, 21, 22 years old. And they all came back, and of course they had to go in front of the legal system, and they were metered out various, punishments. Mm-hmm. The young guys, I think my dad's punishment was you go up to Montana Tech and go to school. Mm-hmm. Or something like that. I think he said he went for just a few months and that didn't quite work out, and you know, then that was over, nothing really came of it. But that was the history of that story. And then after that, of course, he's a young guy and he would just go out and get various jobs that were available in, you know, mining, or he was with the state highway department for a period of time. He worked for the county of Silver Bow for a period of time.
Was he doing manual labor? Did he move up to management?
What he ended up doing through his course of career was to, in his final days, he ran the, I don't know if you'd specifically call it a management position. Back then they called him an engineering position, but they were building engineering. They were the guys that sort of ran the boiler system, kind of ran the maintenance, kept mm-hmm. the building, you know, going. He did that at the old county hospital that I don't know what it is. I think it's a rehabilitation facility now, but it's down off of Continental Drive. That was the county hospital back in the 60s and 70s.
Okay.
He did that for the Civic Center for quite a few years as well. That was, you know, of course, county owned. And then retired from that that work, that government kind of work, local government employment.
Let me ask you about trying to get back to some types of cultural traditions. With the mixed culture, what kind of food traditions did you have in your family? Did you get Croatian food?
No. No. Mm-hmm. I'm not really even sure what Croatian food would be. The thing back then was those people really, they lived through the Depression. So to them, it wasn't necessarily a traditional food that was big for them. It was plenty of food, whatever it was. And in my dad's case, and probably he was the driver of what we primarily ate, but because there were periods of time during the Depression, you know, after the the Prohibition period and all that stuff, where there was, you know, difficult to get work and difficult to feed yourself. And so people had very lean periods of time, and they did go hungry back then. I mean, there wasn't always enough food all the time. So when the economy started to change and these guys, you know, my father included, could start getting, you know, real work and work enough, you know, work valuable enough to support a family, it was, you know, steak and potatoes and every day. I mean, you know, big, you know, juicy, you know,
Meat and potatoes.
Meat and potatoes. Well, I mean, there was a variety, salads, and, you know, but there was, you know, he loved a big steak and a baked potato with all the trimmings. And that, you know, we had some variety, but I mean, that's just, and I could, you know, I understand the deal. It was just something that when you're young and, I mean, and you were deprived of, I mean, that's the thing that now you want. And so he pretty much got it the rest of his life.
So it was basic.
But American fare. There was no traditional. And I don't really remember ever going into anyone else's house where it wasn't the same. I don't ever remember a fixture of traditional food, you know, in this little Butte culture, ever.
Do you remember? It's not connected with food, but there's a, for example. Do you recall attending, or your father attending, any of the traditional Irish wakes, for example?
You know, that tradition, by the time I came along, had pretty well gone out of vogue. So all I can recall is some of his stories, and you know, back when he was a, you know, a young adult, and probably I would bet up through probably the 40s somewhere, or maybe even a little before that, they would have traditional Irish wakes. And he would tell me stories where, of course, they propped the guy up in his casket and, you know, put a cigarette in his hand, a drink in one hand, you know, and they'd all just have a party around, you know, the guy, you know, sitting upright in his casket with a drink in one hand and a cigarette in the other, and be toasting, you know, the guy, you know, through the course of the evening. So that was how I recall the description of the traditional Irish wake. But he did say back in the early days, you know, the Prohibition days, where a lot of guys back then were involved in that kind of thing, you know, in some peripheral sense. So they'd always be thrown in jail, you know, for like a weekend or a week or something. And every once in a while it would sort of catch a guy when he was about ready to get married. So they'd have the marriage in jail. They'd have the wedding in jail. Or he said there were times where they'd actually have the Irish wake in jail. You know, just sort of get, you know, get caught up in that sort of time frame where that was the most practical place then to handle it. I think that was probably, I would say, if you want to really look back and try to capture tradition, I would say the Irish as a tradition were never really all that serious about making everything a criminal activity. And they were pretty loose about that kind of stuff.
And you're talking Irish cops now?
Irish cops, yeah. Right.
And was it possible to get released from jail?
Oh, yeah, guys would go, and I can't remember, you would say, but they'd let guys out if they had some, you know, like, say, maybe a family member died, or, you know, some important family deal particularly, they'd let them out, and they'd go do it, and they'd come back. I mean, it was a period where people really kind of, you know, everybody just sort of agreed to the system, not like today.
But at the same time, they weren't taking the system that seriously, but they were accepting a kind of...
They got caught. They were doing something that was against the rule that somebody decided was a rule, and they got caught, and then, you know, so they did their... You know, they did their punishment, whatever it was. I don't think if it was a real serious thing. I mean, they did have a, you know, a state prison. So, I mean, they, you know, there was a place for those guys. But, you know, I'm talking kind of the, you know, the guy that gets drunk and breaks something. You know, I mean, just these kind of things where they never equaled ever. You know, like today, I mean, you know, you're going to go right straight with the bad gang. You know, there's no... sort of sensible interpretation of, you know, how severe is this crime?
Mm-hmm.
But back then, apparently there was, and that, you know, that's how they kind of managed it in what I would consider today a very sensible method.
Mm-hmm. So it gave a bit more discretion to the cops and to the judges how to deal with individual cases.
Yes.
In a time like that.
And I think that was pretty much the way society operated. You know, if I look back on history, now, you know, we're bound by rules to the nth degree. No flexibility.
But again, the relationship between Irish cops, Irish firefighters, I guess, did that continue in Butte? Did you see a
yes, in that group, between the police department and the fire department, it was predominantly Irish. I mean, all the names were Irish, and certainly the top brass were always Irish. I'm sure there were a few of the others non-Irish that were in, you know, the ranks from time to time. You know, people just have a desire to for certain careers, and they'll find a way in. But certainly the top guys and the predominant, or the majority, were all Irish names.
Did your father or your mother hold on to any of those old traditions from the superstitions, for example, from the old country?
You know, strangely enough, my father did not, of course. He was a real practical-minded kind of guy, real sensible, real... You know, always the kind of guy that just wanted a practical solution to everything. Never believed in, you know, anything, you know, nonsensical.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And never suggested anybody else either. My mother was a bit more superstitious. And I think that probably, you know, probably what it came down to is her, you know, excessive religious bent, you know, versus his non-excessive religious bent.
But it wouldn't have been associated with any of the old Irish superstitions
or
anything like that.
No. I remember my father kind of describing a few to me, but kind of in a way where it was, you know, I don't know who really believes in this business, but here it is.
Mm-hmm. What would you say have been the most striking changes in your life so far? Having grown up in Butte, traveled a lot, come back near Butte, in the country near Butte.
Yeah, I do have that. As you know, there is one striking thing in my life, and that is when I left Butte, I left for good. I mean, I had no notion that I would ever come back. And my mother had a pretty big health problem. She's quite old. She's alive today, but she's 98. And back when she was 89, 10 years ago, she had fallen and broken a major bone structure and needed help. And so I came back and lived here full time for 2 years taking care of her. And really started to re-resonate with the culture and the community. And, you know, so I'm back now. I mean, in fact, today, even though I don't live here most of the year, I'm only here generally in the summer periods, this is my home. And whenever I'm asked, wherever I'm at, even if I'm living there most of the time, I'm from Montana. I'm from Butte, Montana. Where's your home? Butte, Montana. So I really reconnected with my home.
What would you say in your life have been your greatest moment of joy and of sorrow? That's a tough one, I know.
I've never looked at life like that. You know, that's not really an easy question. Not because I would, you know, my sorrowful examples in life I just can't deal with. I've just never looked at life that way. To me, difficult things in life to me were just a challenge to overcome. You know, they were doable. I never thought in my life that there was nothing that any person, but in my case, myself, that couldn't actually get through and deal with. And there's been a lot of challenges, but I never looked at them as a sorrowful, you know, oh, if something happened to me, I'll carry this burden the rest of my life. You know, I just bulldozed through it and overcame it.
Is the same thing true about joy, that you enjoy the pleasure of a success or something, but you don't get exhilarated by it?
No. You know, that was the biggest, you know, the greatest thing for me was growing up in my father's tutelage. He was not a highly educated man, but he had an insight and an intuition way beyond most highly educated men. Mm-hmm. And I saw that very, very early, very young. He was the kind of guy when he sort of was educating you on a way to really think and see the world, you listened. You didn't backtalk. You didn't have a debate. I mean, you really sensed that there was something to listen to here and think about and carry forward in your life. And it wasn't something that was, it wasn't like going to school. You know, it was less frequent than that, but it was powerful enough to where I carried these things through my life, and that was probably, I attribute, the way I conduct myself, and to a large degree, whatever success I've attained was carrying those kinds of standards, and philosophies and thought processes through myself.
I have one final question, and that is, if you could envision yourself writing a history of the Irish in Montana, what do you think you would want to include to pass on to the future?
Well, I guess the way I kind of look at that question is I think that there's always a starting point to something, and then there's a body of work to it, and then there's a conclusion somewhere along the line. And I think in a historical exposé of that nature, you've really got to go back and capture where it all started and why. And then why the body of that culture, you know, flourished in the way that it did. And then did it really conclude somewhere? And was it really a conclusion, or was it just sort of a conclusion of an era, and then these tentacles sort of reached out and did other things? And that's kind of the story of America as well. But if you want to narrow it down to a specific region, I think you've got to capture that trend, that whole sort of beginning, body, and conclusion picture to it all. And that's something that you won't find many people think about in this area. Because the guys you're talking to now are me, and we're old guys, and we didn't grow up with that. We didn't really have that connectivity. I created that connectivity because I just happened to be out in the world sort of going, wow, you know, so very interesting. Now I see things that I never even thought about before. But that would be a real way of understanding, the Irish culture in particular relative to this region. And I've given you a little piece of it. I mean, it started in the Bearhaven Peninsula, and a certain group of those people ended up specifically here. They carried their culture on here. They raised their families. They were still part of a melting pot. They got together with the ladies of other groups and cultures, and, you know, the whole thing sort of evolved from there with a predominant Irish spin to it. Mm-hmm. And then that group now are primarily passed away, and the group such as myself that are getting, you know, at least into the front ranks of that, we're elsewhere. We're doing other things. So there's been a tentacle now that have been, you know, cast about into the larger fabric of America. You know, why was that? I mean, well, where did that come from? Why, we can see where it all started, and there's this, you know, body of work that got put together, and then we're out doing other stuff. So that's how I would see it.
Okay. Thank you very much, Don.
My pleasure.